This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. R. Buckminster Fuller was an inventor, architect, futurist. He's best known for geodesic domes built with interlocking triangles. You can still see them today in Montreal, where they were a centerpiece of Expo 67. Another is the centerpiece and most recognizable icon of Walt Disney World's Epcot Center in Florida. But Fuller was about more than domes. He saw himself as a prophet for technology and how it could be put to use in solving poverty and other problems of humanity. But the reality of his life was more complicated and troubling than the mythology he presented to the public. Fuller lived from 1895 to 1983, and in that time he interacted with luminaries from Albert Einstein to Steve Jobs. He was also a countercultural icon in a suit and inspired a generation of designers and entrepreneurs and thinkers in Silicon Valley. Now Fuller's life is the subject of a new biography by the writer Alec Navalla Lee. It's called Inventor of the Future, The Visionary Life of Buckminster Fuller. The New York Times Book Review says, "The strength of this carefully researched and fair-minded biography is that the reader comes away with a greater understanding of a deeply complicated individual who overcame obstacles, many of his own making, to achieve a kind of imperfect greatness." Alec Navalla Lee was previously on The 21st Show in 2018 when he spoke with my predecessor, Nyla Boodoo, about his previous book, Astounding, John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. He's based in Oak Park, Illinois, and he joins us now. Alec, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here again.
And listeners, if you want to join our conversation, the number to do so is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. I want to begin with this idea of a comprehensive designer, which is how Fuller sort of conceived of himself and has been described. What does that mean?
So Fuller, as I think you may have mentioned, was a countercultural icon, especially, starting in like the late 60s, early 70s. And he really appealed to a lot of the people that ended up being the founders of Silicon Valley. And a big part of this has to do with the concept of being a comprehensive designer. So Fuller was, the kind of person who tended to advocate for solutions to problems that were based on design and technology. So he says, instead of trying to change things through political activism or, other kinds of like more conventional social change, you should just figure out a invention or a design that can solve these problems. And obviously that attitude had an enormous influence on people like Steve Jobs and, other people who were active in, the personal computer revolution. And, to kind of perpetuate that message, Fuller had to embody this kind of idealized generalist. He was a very smart guy. He was a genius and also really great at branding himself, as a certain kind of visionary figure. And he sort of was able to portray himself through his talks and his writings as a person who saw whole systems. You start at the level of the entire universe and work your way down. There's like no aspect of human experience from design to economics to science to physics to geometry that is outside your purview. And I think that image of sort of this holistic thinker ended up being very powerful and very influential.
Yeah, you have this quote from Stuart Brand early in the book who put Fuller on the Whole Earth catalog back in the 60s and said that, attributing this to Fuller, changing human nature is hard, and when you try, you mostly fail, and it's discouraging. Changing tools and technology is relatively easy, which certainly sounds like something you could see out of a Silicon Valley mission statement today. Does he have contemporary analogs in your view?
Yeah, well, if you look at sort of Fuller as what I refer to as the prototype of the startup founder, you see a lot of similarities here. Okay. And it's not an accident. So Fuller was kind of, again, like a major cultural figure at the time when a lot of these values and assumptions were being laid down in Silicon Valley. And the strategies that he used, you see everywhere. So there's a cliche that startups say that if you work for us, we're going to change the world, which might seem like a little bit grandiose if you're just building a cell phone app. But, that kind of messaging comes straight from someone like Fuller. He knew how to attract especially young people. you know, who were unattached and enthusiastic and ready to join up for a crusade. And, you know, the language that he used and the way he framed design as a solution to, you know, bigger problems, it kind of furnished, you know, Silicon Valley with the playbook that it's used ever since to, you know, convince investors and employees to devote themselves to this idea.
So let's talk about how Fuller became who he was. And I mean, there's a lot we could go through, but let's start with his daughter, because he would later say that 1927 was the formative year in his life. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But you really put the hinge date 5 years earlier with his daughter, Alexandra. What happened to her?
So Alexandra was Fuller's first daughter. When she was four, or just before her fourth birthday, she died. You know, she'd been sick as a child. And, you know, Fuller, I think, correctly blamed her death on the flu pandemic, actually, you know, the Spanish flu, which led to health problems that, you know, eventually caused her death. And I think it really influenced him on several levels. You know, on the one hand, I think he accurately said that housing was a huge reason that pandemic was as devastating as it was. You know, people were living together in like close proximity in houses that, you know, were overcrowded. And obviously, like, personal hygiene was not, you know, as advanced as it is now. And a lot of his early designs for housing come out of his attempt to address those issues. But, you know, more to the point, you know, it was devastating. You know, I have a daughter, you know, and I know how difficult it would be for me if she died. And a lot of Fuller's, I would say, his messianic sense of his destiny comes out of the idea that he had lost this, you know, person who was important to him. And after she dies, you see him kind of transforming himself into this, in some ways, like a surrogate father for a lot of younger people. You know, he later had another daughter, Allegra, who he was very close to. But, you know, I do see Fuller channeling a lot of the impulses that he would have had as a father toward the students and collaborators that he later worked with.
So we need to take a break in about a minute. But before we do, I want to talk, because I haven't mentioned yet, but Fuller spent a fair amount of his life, or at least significant periods of his life, in Illinois, in Chicago, and later at Southern Illinois University. What brought him to Chicago for the first time?
Well, I hope we talk about this further, because there's a lot to discuss here. Mm-hmm. I mean, he came to Chicago, you know, for many of the same reasons that Frank Lloyd Wright came here one generation earlier. You know, it was the center of the architectural and construction industry, you know, for reasons that have a lot to do with, you know, the city's history. And so Fuller, in his late 20s, began to work for a company that his father-in-law had founded called Stockade, that had an innovative building material they were trying to sell to construction companies. And Chicago was the obvious place to build up their Midwest office. So he came out here in the 20s, stayed here for a while, and some really interesting stuff happened along the way.
Interesting stuff happened along the way, yes. All right. And he ultimately loses his job, and then comes the night of November 20th, 1927. He goes for a walk toward Lake Michigan, and we're going to leave our listeners there. We need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what happened at this fateful night, as Fuller describes it, sort of a hinge moment in his life, in his thinking, in who he would become. We're going to continue our conversation with Alec Navala Lee. The book is Inventor of the Future, The Visionary Life of Buckminster Fuller. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with writer Alec Navala Lee, based in Oak Park, Illinois, about his new book, Inventor of the Future, The Visionary Life of Buckminster Fuller, about the futurist and designer, the comprehensive designer is how many people have characterized Fuller's work, which spanned much of the 20th century. He interacted with a lot of the luminaries of that century, but this was not something that was destined for him from the beginning of his life. And before the break, we were talking about his trajectory, which had brought him to Chicago to work in the construction industry. Ultimately, he loses his job, and on the night of November 20th, 1927, he goes for a walk toward Lake Michigan. And Alec, can you take the story from there? What happens on this walk?
Yes. So this is a very interesting moment in his life that for, you know, at first seems like it might be invented or like just part of the myth that he later developed about, you know, his journey. But if you look at his papers and records, you know, I was able to pinpoint, I think fairly accurately, that it took place, as you said, on November 20th, 1927. So he goes to Lake Michigan. He has just lost his job. He has a wife and a young daughter and no real prospects. And he thinks about committing suicide. All right. Which, if you know Lake Michigan, this is a very difficult way to die. You know, it's not a jump. You would simply have to swim out as far as you could until you got tired and sank. But he claims that that's what he went there to do. But instead, you know, he's standing there, you know, looking out, and it's around Thanksgiving, and he's starting to like question the value of his life. And he asks himself, you know, do I know best or does God know best whether I have any value to the universe? And according to Fuller, he had this rush of insight, and he basically said to himself, you do not belong to you. You belong to the universe. And you and all men are here for the sake of other men. And for him, as he later describes it, you know, this is the moment that he decided to structure his life, you know, for the sake of others, as a kind of experiment to see what one person could accomplish that could not be accomplished through more conventional approaches, the kinds that he'd been trying up until that point. And, you know, there is a mythical aspect to the story. Fuller was a flawed person. And even after this moment of insight, you know, he still makes mistakes and he does things that, you know, are personally messy, shall we say. But I do think it was a turning point. I do think that his vision of himself and his destiny was shaped on that night.
We have a caller on the line from Benjamin is calling from Girard on line 4 at 800-222-9455. Benjamin, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I wanted to ask your guest there a quick question about how they perceive the notion of myth or myth-making. And it seems like it's become synonymous with a falsehood, but, you know, it would be nicer if it was referred to as a way of, you know, imbuing things with meaning. And, you know, in light of the story you just told there, it seems like, you know, Buckminster Fuller's legacy, you know, can be seen in that way of like trying to, you know, make meaning in light of this grand, you know, connection with the universal, and that a lot of the material expression of that legacy is just a byproduct of that philosophical attempt to integrate our, you know, mundane human concerns with these large universal patterns.
Benjamin, thank you for the call. Alec, I wonder what you make of that.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I sort of see Fuller as being a quintessential American figure, where you have someone who is undeniably a genius in many ways, who is also a myth maker. And, you know, it can be hard to understand, you know, what drives these people. But one thing I learned about Fuller reading, you know, like his papers and looking at his life is that, you know, he did things for a reason. He always had grand objectives, you know, things he wanted to achieve. And for him, you know, the story he was telling about himself, the narrative of his life as he revised it, was a tool. It was sort of one of the most effective, you know, means at his disposal for motivating other people, because he realized, I would say, by the late 40s, that he was going to work on these amazing designs, the dome, and, you know, other things that did capture people's attention, but none of them were as compelling as his example, you know, as the story he told. And so what you see is this pattern of him going back and pulling out aspects of his biography and, you know, embellishing certain things and downplaying other things to fit that pattern, to say, here's my story. This is the model you have for how to get things done, you know, in the way that I think is best. And you can take lessons from, you know, my example. And I understand that. And I think it's an incredibly powerful way to motivate people. But I also think that for it to be truly useful, you have to understand the actual costs of becoming that kind of person, because there are always consequences. You know, there are consequences to living your life in that way. And they aren't always obvious from the version of himself that Fuller presented to the world, but they do come very, they become very clear when you review the primary sources and see how these events actually happened. And so a big part of my purpose in writing this book was to kind of get beyond the myth and actually unpack how Fuller did what he did and what it means for the rest of us.
Yeah, and you're correlating these things he says in speeches much later in life. You're going back looking at his diary and his contemporaneous letters through his papers. What did you come to understand about him, about those costs you just referenced?
Well, you know, so one interesting obstacle to understanding Fuller is that he became famous like very late in his life compared to, you know, many other similar figures. So, you know, the vision of, or the image of Fuller that people have tends to be of Fuller in his 60s and 70s and even his 80s. And obviously it's like, you know, that man, that older man you see is the product of a younger man who you don't see. Right. And the version of him that became, you know, so celebrated is the product of, you know, a lot of mistakes and a lot of wrong turns. So, for example, he had, you know, a lot of interpersonal conflict with his collaborators. You know, these are investors, these are business partners, these are even his students and people who work with him on these designs, you know, where he would clash with them and, you know, fight over credit and sometimes erase them entirely from the narrative. And, you know, this is something that becomes very clear when you look, go back and look at his earlier life when he was 30, 40, 50. And, you know, if he did seem like he had achieved some measure of serenity or you know, peace toward the end, I think it comes out of those early conflicts. I think you can't understand the person that he became or that he appeared to be without coming to terms with the much more complex figure that he was earlier in his life.
So you mentioned he became famous in his 60s, and this is also the time when he returns to Illinois and becomes a faculty member in design at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I like the warning that I think it was Harold Cohen who recommended him for this job, but warned people that he was not a teacher, he just talks. What was it like being a student of Buckminster Fuller in Southern Illinois in the late 50s, early 60s?
So Fuller, you know, was not always on campus, all right? So this is a period when he's actually earning more money through lecturing and through these public appearances than he does through his actual patents. And so around this time, and we're talking like, you know, the 60s and early 70s, he is on the road almost throughout the entire year. You know, he's lecturing at different colleges, he's overseas. And so, you know, the amount of time he spends physically on the SAU campus is limited. He does, you know, become notorious for giving these hours-long lectures that are often really fascinating, but some people find them lacking in practical instruction, shall we say, you know, and some people have trouble getting through them. You know, there are stories about students being given caffeine pills just so they can stay awake, you know, throughout these lectures. But the biggest thing, you know, that I want to point out is that he would use students as his research team. So if he had a design for a dome, you know, at this period, he didn't really have a engineering, you know, a company that could conduct these, you know, these trials or, you know, work on different designs, but he had students. And so often at a seminar or in a class, he would have students at SIU and other universities actually design, engineer, and build these domes that he could then use for other projects. And so there's this amazing sense in which he actually kind of built a virtual corporation on top of the existing platform of the university system. And he used, you know, SIU's resources and its office space, you know, really to conduct his own projects. And that's kind of a big part of the reason that he left, because eventually the university decided that it was no longer feasible to support him in the way they had in the past.
In the time we have remaining, I do want to talk about where we can see evidence of Fuller's vision in our lives today, beyond maybe Walt Disney World and Spaceship Earth and the Expo 67 geodesic domes. Where should people look for evidence of Fuller?
So there are really two places. Okay, so if you want to look for physical artifacts, you know, the dome is still around. Okay, if you go to a playground and see a climbing dome, that's there because of Fuller and his colleagues. The climbing dome comes directly out of his work. And so, you know, if you ever played on that as a kid or seen your kids on one of those climbing structures, you know, that's Fuller. Dome tents for backpackers, you know, that's an idea that you can trace back directly to Fuller's ideas. So, you know, I could point to a lot of these.
Yeah, no, dome tents, I love that. And I learned in reading your book that the annoying sleeves that you have to thread certain dome tents through was because of a dispute among some of the people who were trying to carry out his vision, right?
Yeah, no, I learned that, you know, when I was doing research. And it's like an example of how, yeah, these design principles in reality, in practice, you know, they can be hard to, you know, execute sometimes for reasons like patents or, you know, the rights to these ideas. But the other thing about Fuller I want to underline is that, you know, his biggest influence is probably less tangible. So things like the word synergy, all right? So, you know, during the 60s, let's say, Fuller would often ask people in an audience, you know, how many of you know the word synergy? And raise your hand. And very few people had ever heard that term. And now I would say for most people, synergy isn't just a familiar term, it's a cliche. It's like sort of this, you know, the epitome of business speak that, you know, 100%, kind of yeah. causes people to roll their eyes. But, you know, the fact that, you know, he single-handedly popularized that concept is remarkable. You know, we wouldn't talk about synergies or synergy without Fuller's example to follow. You know, things like the phrase spaceship Earth, you know, come right from Fuller. Ideas like doing more with less, and the fact that technology trends toward invisibility or abstraction, you know, these are things that Fuller was talking about as early as the 30s. So, you know, in terms of his invisible influence on the culture, it's everywhere. It's really remarkable.
Last question, I think. I wonder what this process of writing this book was like, as different from your previous, for example, the group biography of science fiction writers. I mean, Fuller could present as a pretty unpleasant person in a lot of ways. You have this quote from Harold Cohen, who says he was brilliant, but somehow devoid of emotion for the plight of people, except in the abstract sense.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The process was a little similar because, you know, in both of these books I've written, the ideas I had going in were very different from the impressions I had coming out. In Fuller's case, I am and, you know, have always been a Fuller fan. And I wrote this book in large part because I thought his ideas were fascinating and I wanted to introduce them to a wider audience. And looking back at, you know, my original proposal, I think my picture of Fuller was actually fairly idealized. I think it kind of drew on the picture of Fuller that you see in other biographies and other books, you know, that don't go back to the sources and kind of trust him as the ultimate, you know, arbiter of what really happened. But then you go back to these hundreds of boxes of books in his archives, and you talk to people that knew him personally. And, you know, as you know, this much more complex figure emerges. But I would say I had no idea that any of this stuff was true until I'd already signed the contract and had been at work on this book for a while. So, you know, the complex Fuller that I hope emerges from this biography is actually very different from the version of him that I had in my mind when I started. And I think that's reflected in the finished book.
Well, Alec Navalli, congratulations on publication. It's getting great reviews. The book is called Inventor of the Future, The Visionary Life of Buckminster Fuller. Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your work on the 21st show.
Thanks, Brian. It was my pleasure.
Before we go, I want to take a moment to recognize Nichelle Nichols. The actress best known for portraying Lieutenant Uhura on Star Trek died over the weekend in New Mexico. Nichols was born in Illinois, in the city of Robbins, raised in Chicago. As the communications officer on the USS Enterprise, at the time she was a rare black actor cast in a role that was not subservient. She often recounted how this point was made clear to her in 1967 when she met Dr. Martin Luther King and revealed to him that she planned to leave the show. She explained what happened next in this clip from the Television Academy Foundation.
He said, "For the first time on television, we will be seen as we should be seen every day, as intelligent, quality, beautiful people who can sing, dance, and but who can go into space." And my life's never been the same.
Nichelle Nichols, Lieutenant Uhura, died Saturday. She was 89 years old. And that's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.